Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Anand Agarwal to the broadcast. Anand is the president of edX, a non-for-profit massive open online course, or MOOC-based, online learning destination founded by MIT and Harvard universities. Anand taught the first edX course on circuits and electronics from MIT, which drew 155,000 students from 162 countries. He has served as the director of CSAIL, MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, and is a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. He's a successful serial entrepreneur, having co-founded several companies, including Telera Corporation, which created the Tile multi-core processor and Virtual Machine Works. Anand won the Maurice Wilkes Prize for Computer Architecture and MIT's Smullen and Jameson Prizes for Teaching. He's also the author of the textbook Foundations of Analog and Digital Electronic Circuits. Anand holds a PhD from Stanford and a bachelor's degree from IIT Madras. I recently caught up with Anand in his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as Anand described the precursors to the MOOCs at MIT, the path edX has taken, and his vision for the future. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open-source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com.
I thought we would begin with the beginning of edX and the beginning of your involvement with it. Can you tell us a bit about the genesis of the idea, how it occurred to you, and kind of some of those early objectives? What was the identification of the opportunity in its earliest stages?
Sure. At MIT, we've been very heavily involved in online learning of various sorts for 15 years. Starting with OpenCourseWare in the early part of this decade. And I myself have been playing around with an online laboratory called WebSim, W-E-B-S-I-M, and have been building an online lab with, over time, several hundred students from around the world would come to the lab and do online experiments. I'd always felt that being able to do online lab experiments was sort of one of the open research challenges for online learning to be successful. And then last year, we decided, this was in late 2011, we decided, you know, let's go build a platform and put MIT courses online. So we formed MITx and announced it in December of 2011. So we announced the platform and we offered a first course on circuits and electronics. And the response was staggeringly good. We had 155,000 students from all around the world to take the course. It certainly surprised us. This was an MIT hard course with differential equations as prerequisites, so it really surprised us. And then MIT and Harvard got to talking and decided to partner up, and we launched edX. MITx morphed into edX in early May of 2012. A number of universities also contacted us, suggesting that they liked our nonprofit mission, the open source platform. And they were also very interested in coming on board as edX partners, and so we decided to expand the partnership and really work with other universities offering courses on our platform. So really, that was sort of the genesis of edX.
That's wonderful. I wonder, especially in those early stages, was there any misgivings about the extent to which this might cannibalize the existing offering? Now, naturally, of course, this does not replicate the experience of being on MIT's or Harvard's or Berkeley's or McGill's or Georgetown's campuses. But at the same time, it is access to the professors that make those universities, or at least some of the professors that make those universities famous. Was there ever any consternation over the possibility that this was something that was cannibalizing the value of these universities' educations?
Remembering the environment we were coming from, you know, MIT had launched OpenCourseWare about 10 years ago, and there, a lot of online content available. Course materials from MIT courses were already available to the public. You know, there are thousands of courses on OpenCourseWare. And so we've had that experience, and OpenCourseWare was definitely very good for MIT, good for all of us, and good for the world. And so therefore, there was no real strong concern as to whether this would hurt MIT and Harvard's reputations. Rather, we felt that this was a very good thing to do. to increase access to learning for students around the world. A major motivation was to reinvent how education happened on our own campuses so that we could apply these new technologies to learning on our own campuses and really reinvent how education happened on our campuses. So we felt that online learning was a huge disruptive force, and we certainly felt it was better for us to be part of it and to steer it for both improving on-campus education and increasing access. And so, you know, that's why we sort of launched it.
That's really great. Talk to me about the way in which you see this changing the model for students who are on those campuses. So, for instance, your MIT students. Obviously, part of this is access to materials and to university professors who are not at MIT, but part of edX. I assume also that part of the value is beginning the course room experience on a higher plane, that there is a foundation that is laid through the use of edX's materials that then can be built upon through the classroom setting. Is that a fair synopsis of at least a portion of the value intended?
Absolutely, yeah, that makes complete sense. And was certainly one of the big motivations for doing edX in a way that improved our campus experience. So as one example that I'll give you, edX replaces on-campus lectures with the online learning sequences, which are, you know, short video snippets interleaved with interactive exercises and virtual laboratories. Now, so students can now watch these on our own campuses in their own dorm rooms at their own time and their own pace. And just imagine, you know, you can pause a lecture, you can rewind a lecture. You know, you can't do that in a classroom, and you can watch this at midnight. We are finding that the largest amount of access happens between midnight and 2 a.m. I hated going to early morning classes myself. So students like it a lot. It improves the quality of learning because students can pace themselves. And this is a form of learning called active learning, where rather than sitting in lecture and passively listening to an hour-long lecture, here, after every 5 or 10 minutes, you are interacting with the content. You're answering a question or doing a little laboratory piece. This active learning has been known to really improve learning outcomes. So I think this is a good thing for our campuses. And I like to say that online learning is like a rising tide that will lift all boats. It will improve campus learning, and it will also increase access to education everywhere.
What do you foresee this does in changing the experience for professors themselves? Obviously, in some ways, this has a fundamental shift, as what used to be the majority of what they were responsible for in the classroom is now provided once and leveraged many, many times, this kind of typical software model. And now what they're bringing to bear in the classroom is quite different. Can you talk a little bit, as a professor yourself, how this changes the preparation that a professor goes through in preparing for courses and the classroom experience in a different way than was traditionally the case?
Absolutely. Online learning is good for both professors and the students. Just as a number, right now, about 1,500 students at MIT are accessing the edX platform on the campus in one way, shape, or form. This is about 25% of the students at MIT. So this is seeing ample use on campus. The way it impacts professors is that in the past, you know, I would have to go into class and give the same lecture semester upon semester. And of course, our lectures change a little bit, but still, you know, I'm cracking the same old jokes, and I would have 2 or 3 demonstrations, and I would cycle between the demonstrations, and I could do them in my sleep. So certainly, that's a big part of it. And if students don't like doing an early morning lecture, hey, you know, so do some professors like myself. So this is good for all of us. Also, grading is a real chore that professors have to do, where oftentimes they would order in pizza, and the teaching assistants and the instructors would sit down and spend all day grading a midterm exam. Now we have computing technologies that do online grading and that provide instant feedback to the students. And students are loving that instant feedback. In fact, they get a little green check mark when they get something right, and they get multiple tries. So they don't make silly mistakes anymore because they can check their answer and they can get multiple tries. And students are telling us that they go to bed at night dreaming of the green check mark. So besides the fun of instant feedback, there are many studies that have shown that instant feedback also improves learning outcomes. It introduces the element of gamification. So automatic grading helps professors be able to leverage a lot of the online videos and lectures, really helps professors. And this frees up the professor's time for what you might think of as much more highly value-add activities with the students. They could interact one-on-one with students. They could do projects with students. They could perform research with students. They could, you know, have sort of an apprenticeship model with students. So these are all what one might regard as sort of higher levels of interaction with students in helping students learn how to learn, as opposed to, you know, standing in front of a classroom and, you know, spouting forth content.
You mentioned a couple of the early courses that were proposed to be used, and I wonder now, as more courses have been offered, are there certain kinds of courses, or are there certain kinds of professors for that matter, that seem to be particularly well received? Are there topics that seem to be less well rendered when they're put through an online format like what we're describing? What sort of learnings have you had now with a few years under your belt and a great number of courses from a number of leading universities that have gone through the edX system now?
Sure. So first of all, it's only a year, although it does seem like a decade, doesn't it? But we do have a number of courses. We have about 30, 35 courses on a platform. These are in disciplines ranging from the science of cooking to Greek history and the humanities, to engineering, to science, to public health, to law. Courses in a number of areas. And we are constantly surprising ourselves. If you'd asked me a year ago, will you be able to do this? I'll give you an example or two. I would have been amazed that we'd be able to do it in a year. So, for example, we now have on our platform technologies that enables us to grade free-form essays and free-form answers. And we have three technologies to do that: AI assessment, peer assessment, and self-assessment. With AI assessment, our team at edX has really innovated heavily and uses machine grading to grade essays. And it's a really unique technology using machine learning. We also have peer grading, where students grade each other's work, and self-assessment, where students grade themselves. And if you'd asked me when we began this a little over a year ago as to whether we would be grading free-form essays routinely, I would have said, oh, that will take a few years for us to get there. But we've already begun doing that using AI assessment. It's a really huge innovation. Another example is, if you'd asked me a year and a half ago, will you be able to replicate the small, intimate feel of a small group discussion in a small liberal arts college, I would have said, I don't know how to do that. But the edX team is a team of rock stars. The edX team has come up with a way of doing that as well. They have invented cohorts. We do have a discussion forum. We've had a discussion forum on our last platform since the very beginning, where students can ask questions and get answers on the discussion forum. With cohorts, we've now introduced a way to create small discussion groups where the professor can divide up a large class into smaller groups, and students can have a much more intimate discussion in a smaller group setting. In fact, a professor can also create a discussion group or discussion groups based on a student's answer to a previous question. So this concept of cohorts is a very handy concept and something that I think we surprised ourselves, certainly our team surprised me in pulling it off.
Speaking of the group that you've pulled together, which I'm curious, how have you thought about staffing edX between people like yourself who have experience not only with technology from an academic setting, but from an implementation setting, a set of experiences? How have you pulled together the team that can both operationalize the ideas while also having the content experts, so to speak, weighing in as well?
It's a great question, Peter. I myself have serial entrepreneur, having done several startup companies in my career. And so we are running edX like a non-profit startup company. Now, there's an oxymoron for you. But in every respect, I'd love for you to come and visit edX. It has a look and feel of a startup company. And so we're really running it like a startup. But from a principal standpoint, it's non-profit. We are focused on principles, not profit. But in every respect, it's run like a startup. And so the way we pull our team together is both operationally and from a business sense and a strategic sense. We have a number of people who've got ample startup experience. So, for example, Rob Rubin is our head of engineering. He came from Carbonite. He was head of engineering there, and he's got a sequence of startups under his belt. Matt Malloy, who is our VP of marketing operations, he used to be head of marketing at Zipcar, and he's done a number of startups himself. But we also have academics. So, our effort combines both academics and content and also has to build a cutting-edge platform. So we have some great technologists and, some really great software people from the Cambridge area who are real rock stars. And we also have people who come from academia. We have Tina Herlihy, who came from MIT, from the legal office. She's a VP of Legal and Business Affairs. We have Akiba Kovit, who used to be an associate dean at Harvard, and he heads up university partnerships at edX. So we really have a great combination mix of university leaders and startup-experienced entrepreneurs and operational leaders. And I think a team like that is really what you need to pull off a academic startup and a social entrepreneurship startup like edX.
There's obviously been an awful lot that's been written, and for good reason, about the so-called MOOCs. In this increasingly crowded field, how do you see your organization differentiating from, say, the Courseras or Udacities of the world?
First of all, is that the more people that are engaged with online learning and education and improving the quality of education, expanding education, I view all of that as a good thing. And this may also serve as a differentiator in the sense that we are a nonprofit. We also are based on an open source platform. So our courses are free and our platform is also free. We make our platform available to anybody that is interested in using our platform and our software to create courses themselves. But we are all also very heavily focused on improving campus education. That was one of the primary reasons why both our founding partners, MIT and Harvard, invested the $60 million into edX, and also why a number of our, most of our other partners, ex-consortium partners, 28 of them, are on board edX, where improving campus education and improving education overall is a big part of the mission. And then finally, the point number four is research, where we have a big focus on research in learning, where we gather huge amounts of data on our platform, and we share the data with all our partners. And they're all doing research on how students are learning, and that's another big part of our focus. So I would say four key aspects where I think we are focused on and pretty unique. One is nonprofit. Second is open source platform. Third is improving campus education is a big part of our mission. And fourth, research is also a big part of our mission. So I think these are sort of four aspects that are very important to edX.
And Anand, earlier we talked about the implications of edX on the relevant campuses that are now part of the organization. As you've spoken, for good reason, you've talked about a balance between the benefit of edX to the universities who are participating and their students and their faculty, while also the obvious benefits to people who are not at those universities, who now can take world-class courses that are offered from some leading faculty on interesting topics without necessarily living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, for instance, and enrolling at MIT or Harvard or any of the other august institutions that are part of edX. As you think about the balance between benefits to the constituent universities versus the benefits to people, be they faculty or students, outside of that, is it equal in your mind in terms of that focus, or is there more of a focus on one versus the other?
We haven't looked in detail at what the relative benefits are, but I can tell you this much, there are strong benefits to both for the faculty and students on the campuses of our university partners, and certainly for the faculty. The faculty get to create the MOOC courses and increase the reach of the educational missions of their own institutions. And the benefits to the faculty and students on the campuses is that they get to use the same courses that they've produced. They get to use them in a blended form on their own campus, thereby improving campus education as well. And that's on the campuses that are our partners. For other universities that are not directly partnered with edX, first of all, we have made our platform open source, so any university can use it. And in fact, as you know, Stanford University is using our open source platform, and even though they are not a X consortium edX partner. But that said, a number of other universities are working with edX in a variety of ways. One is we work with them to license and use courses in a way that might reflect a next generation textbook. And many of these universities are not only creating courses themselves on our platform, but they can also use course content created by others. And just like you would use a textbook written by somebody else, here you can use a course created by somebody else on your own campus and use it in as little or more of the course as you like to improve your own educational experience for your own students.
That's excellent. Does this open up the possibility for creative sort of adjunct faculty, so to speak? I don't know if that would be the right terminology, but obviously traditionally many universities, of course, have adjunct faculty that they leverage. But oftentimes there, at least historically, there has been a need for the faculty to come to the university itself in order to participate. Whereas, of course, this is a platform where one's place is not necessarily as relevant as it once was for people to leverage the content. Do you see this as an opportunity to partner with faculty in a different kind of way in different places and geographies as a result?
So it's hard to say. If you look at mixes of faculties in universities today, that there's a mix of faculty, of full-time faculty, part-time faculty, adjunct faculty, postdoctoral lecturers, consulting faculty from industry. There's always been a mix, and universities use this mix to enhance the learning experience for their students. Now, suppose a university wants to use a course created by somebody else, and they don't have any existing faculty member to teach that course. And let's say it's not a very common course. Maybe the course is taught once in 2 years or once in 3 years. And it's not a very common course. And a small number of the students are interested in taking the course. Previously, they would simply not offer the course, and the students would not have an option to take the course. However, now they do have the option of having one of their existing faculty or maybe a part-time faculty to help teach that course on campus so that the students can get that additional experience as well.
What are some of the key performance indicators that you and your organization hold dear in order to determine whether or not you're successful?
So we are still trying to figure out exactly what the right metrics are, but one standard measure that has been used in the past is simply how many students successfully pass a course. If we can improve the number of learners that pass a course on campus from traditional numbers, then we could argue that we have improved the quality of the course. And so, you know, as an example, we did an experimental offering with San Jose State University in California, where they offered an edX course in a blended model on their campus. And traditionally, in previous semesters, the retake rate for the course was on the order of 40 to 41%. The semester when they taught using the edX course in a blended model, the retake rate fell down to 9%. But that is clearly one important performance indicator. Are there other performance indicators, you know, student happiness and so on? I'm sure there are. But this is one that is certainly very concrete and measurable.
That's wonderful. As you look to the future, how do you see this evolving? Obviously, it's had a bit of a life of its own, and its roots, as you point out, actually go back two decades. But as you look towards the decade ahead, what sort of evolution do you see in edX?
I would say that if you look back 1 year, online learning, you know, has come a long way. But to be clear, as you said, its roots have been really standing on the shoulders of giants, and the roots of that have spanned 20 years, you know, going back to OpenCourseWare, and even before that, to all the online learning experiments that a number of universities have been doing over time. So even in this past year, we've accomplished a lot. And going ahead, it's very risky to predict where things are going to go, but in general, I think that two or three things will happen. I think we will see, we're now entering into a phase where we've been gathering a lot of data. We have more than a million learners on the edX platform from every single country in the world. But I think going ahead, we're going to see an increased focus on research. We have all the data. Some papers have already begun coming out. I think we will see a much bigger focus on research going ahead from our partner institutions and others. Second, I think we're already seeing the application of edX courses on campuses as blended courses, and I think we will see a lot more of that. So, for example, at a number of our partner campuses, these courses will be used in a blended model. And just as an example, at MIT, I believe around 1,500 students are using various aspects of online materials combined with in-person in their courses. So I expect to see that number increasing as well. And I expect to see that over the next year or two. Now, where do we expect things to be in 10 years? That's really hard to predict. I mean, things are going at such an incredible pace that I think anything we predict is going to be wrong.
I'd be interested in sort of understanding from you some of the updates and some of the things I would prime you for regarding corporate training, for example, and the use of MOOCs to help keep employees' skills up to date, for instance. Can you talk a bit about your foray into the corporate setting?
You know, but we've always said we want to democratize education. And it actually turns out that as much is being spent for continuing education and corporate training as is spent in traditional higher ed. So it's a really big area, and more people are looking to learn while they work. And in fact, I believe that the one approach of education, I wrote a blog post on Huffington Post a couple of days ago called Unbundled, where I really make the case that a continuous education might be the wave of the future. So with edX, viewed as part of our mission to address people in all areas, we started off with higher ed. Last week, we announced a partnership with the College Board and Davidson College to create AP course modules for high schools. And we're also working with corporations. So, for example, we are working with a company called Tenaris, which is a worldwide conglomerate, and we are hosting a platform for them for their internal corporate education. We're also working with the IMF, International Monetary Fund, in a similar manner, and a few other corporations as well that we have not announced yet.
The opportunity to approach AP courses, how did that come to light?
So just to be clear, we started off in higher ed, and we're now a couple of years into it. And we saw a huge demand from high schools. You need a funnel into the college courses. And if you don't have the funnel, people can't address the college courses. And then people who take the college courses want continuing ed. And so it's natural to work with high schoolers and corporate ed. The way the AP came about was that the Davidson College became an edX partner. And they were very interested in working with high schools and creating AP course modules that they could pilot in high schools. And that could also help incoming students into universities master the material before they come into universities. And even within edX, I personally have been very excited about high school learning. I have a lot of personal interest in that. So when Davidson mentioned that they would like to do that, I was very enthusiastic, and they brought in College Board, and then the three of us partnered on it, and that's how it came about.
As I've been reading through recent data, both positive as well as highlighting some of the challenges of the MOOCs, it's been quite interesting. The degree in which people are collaborating online, the rapidity with which they are finding answers to questions by virtue of the wide number of people who are taking the same courses with them, and rather than the simple limitations of being on the same campus with individuals taking a course. And then on the flip side, there's a statistic that suggests, for instance, that 90% of people who sign up for MOOCs don't necessarily carry them through to their completion. As you read the tea leaves that that you have access to, where would you hypothesize things are currently?
You know, these are early days. We are barely a couple of years into it. In late 2011, following OpenCourseWare and Sal Khan's courses, Sebastian Thrun put his AI course online, and that catalyzed a number of us to put courses online. It catalyzed certainly me and others at MIT. It catalyzed his own colleagues at Stanford. And so a number of courses came online within a few months after Sebastian's course, and topics ranging from circuits and electronics from MIT to machine learning and databases from Stanford. But it's still only 2 years, and there's a lot of things are going well. Already within 2 years, we're doing a number of things much better than we did before, but there's still a long ways to go. We continue refining and improving our technology, refining social interaction. This is one example. There's a study done by MIT and Harvard that showed students who worked together did better overall in the course. And so now one could argue that, look, this is pretty obvious. You know, we've always felt that, but it's nice to see data coming out, and online, we can be gathering all of this data, and researchers can do a study based on quantitative statistical analysis with the big data of learning. So I think we have a long way to go, and I would like to make the argument that we all remember Alta Vista from the late 80s, and Alta Vista to Google today is 25 years, and so it took quite a while to perfect search. Now, even there, search is a long way to go, but still, it took 25 years. And so we are just 2 years into it, and with edX, we are in it for the long haul. We are going to make this work. And we're viewing this as a long-term effort. We're in this for 10, 20 years. We are going to make this work. And this is, education is too important to make a change at the first sign of difficulty. I think we've seen challenges all the way, and we've been overcoming challenges on a regular basis. And so we continue to strive to do better.
You mentioned these are early days, and therefore the pace of change is quite rapid currently. Can you tell us a bit about some of the things that are in the hopper currently that you're thinking about, some of the things that are exciting you in terms of some of the changes you'd hope to enact in the months ahead?
You know, being a nonprofit and being a startup, we're still a startup. You know, we keep trying many new experiments, and some things work and some things don't work. So one example of something we tried and that failed, we did a job placement experiment, and we have stopped working on that. That experiment did not succeed. And the reason was that to really do a good job at that, we would have to really, really focus on job placement. We could not be both a MOOC provider and an educator and a job placer. So we decided to, in some sense, unbundle it. So we unbundled it and said, look, we're not going to get into the job placement market, focus on education. So that's one thing we piloted, and then we decided to discontinue. We are looking at a number of other approaches. We care deeply about campus education, and we're really excited about the blended model of learning, where a number of campuses are taking edX courses and combining them with in-person on campuses. And we have a number of pilots ongoing. We continue to do one at San Jose State University that is going really well. It's now into its third semester. And early results on that are coming out and look very good. So the blended model is very exciting. I think open source is very exciting. We open sourced our platform 6 months ago, and we've had just extraordinary adoption around the world and huge partnerships. Stanford University partnered with us, and they've become a big contributor to edX. It's really been helping open edX. A number of countries have adopted the edX open source platform, like France, for example, the Middle East, China, and we are in conversation with a number of other countries. So the nationwide adoptions of open source platforms has also been very exciting for us. It will really accelerate the democratization of education.
You mentioned earlier sort of the order and sequence of things that led to edX, and you were kind enough to mention some of the early work of Sebastian Thrun, which was sort of the precursor on his end, of course, of Udacity. Out of Stanford also emerged Coursera. You also mentioned Sal Khan and the Khan Academy. These are early days, as you point out, and so winners certainly haven't yet been declared and probably will not be for some time. But what is the state of competition in your mind?
Well, remember, we are a nonprofit, and so for nonprofits, the more the merrier. So we made a platform open source, and so people are, Google was building their own platform, so was Stanford, we're all partners now, and we're collaborating. So, I would say the sequence, OpenCourseWare came out, early part of the last decade. There was Khan Academy, Sal Khan, turned out he was my student at MIT, curiously enough. And then, Sebastian was inspired by Sal Khan. So he launched his first MOOC course a couple of years ago. And that certainly, I had been doing some work with online labs. It was not MOOC. I built an online lab about 10 years ago, an online circuits laboratory. And I had about 300 students a day taking that online lab from all over the world. It wasn't a MOOC by any standards, but it was free. And you can go there, go to that site. It's called WebSim. I was doing that. So a number of people in universities had been playing around with online technologies, and some like Sal Khan and even myself had made our online platform available to the world, and students around the world were using my experiments. And then Sebastian put his course online, second part of 2011, and that certainly catalyzed several others. That catalyzed several courses from Stanford, catalyzed our own circuits course from MIT. And then these courses came up in quick succession. And then, Udacity was formed, and then edX and Coursera were formed. And then many other companies, NovoEd, FutureLearn, Iversity, there's just a large number of companies that are popping up. And education is very exciting. So we're really excited that there's OpenCourseWare, Khan Academy, all of these things have turned into a movement, which is very exciting.
Anant, I greatly appreciate you taking this time and sharing your perspectives on what is such an interesting industry and a very interesting company more specifically, and certainly wish you well in that journey in the coming decades and beyond.
Thank you, Peter.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat believes in the value of a connected ecosystem to inspire innovation for tomorrow. To learn more, visit redhat.com. Listen to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.